This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. I'm speaking to you live from our broadcasting studio in Edmond this morning. I don't get over to this part of the campus very often, but most of what we do on Trumpet Hour, we have to pre-record because we're speaking with people on multiple continents and dealing with odd time zones. But I thought I'd mix things up a bit today, savor a bit of the pressure of live radio that Stephen Fleury capably handles every day. Today we are sending the April issue of the Trumpet Magazine to the printer. It is a real blockbuster issue. I can't even reveal everything that we have in this issue. We actually have a top secret scoop. It won't be top secret within a day or two, but it is right now. That is the cover story of this issue, so stay tuned. That's going to be revealed soon. But we do have a terrific article from our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury. The title is Nunes Memo Exposes Unseen Threat to America. And the quip is, Americans should be deeply alarmed by revelations of corruption and lawlessness within the nation's top law enforcement agencies. It is our responsibility to cut through the noise and politics to understand the truth. And accompanying that article, we have an infographic from Andrew Miller with the title, The Story Behind the Nunes Memo, How Did an Unverified Propaganda Dossier Become the Driving Force in a Conspiracy to Undermine the Trump Presidency? This ties in with the main topic that we're going to cover on today's program. We also, in this issue, have a couple of articles from Stephen Fleury, the Trumpet Daily Radio Show host. One of them is The King of Debt, talking about America's precarious economic position. He's also written one on Why Study History. That's something that he's been covering quite a bit on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show lately. This article also has an article from this issue has an article from Richard Palmer on how modern surveillance technology could be used to implement the biblical prophecy of the mark of the beast. That is a very compelling article from Richard. We have also an article from Dennis Leap on expression suppression and how colleges in particular are shutting down free speech. I read last week about a class at Princeton University that was intended to explore the legal and cultural limits of free speech. The title of the class was Cultural Freedoms, Hate Speech, Blasphemy, and Pornography. Like, how much should society tolerate these things? In America, freedom of speech is protected by the First Amendment, but what are the limits of that protection? So these are pretty important questions to address, especially in light of how much these things are being attacked today, some of them anyway. But a Huffington Post article about this incident at Princeton said this, the purpose of the course, this is according to the chair of Princeton's anthropology department, was to give students the ability to clearly state why hate speech should or should not be protected using an argument other than because it made me feel bad. That's what you're seeing more and more in universities. You see, we hear about the snowflake students that are offended by everything and so on. Well, do you have any guesses as to what happened to this class? This what was supposed to be an intellectual discussion about free speech. The students got upset about the professor's approach, and they loudly protested. Multiple students walked out. One student got up right in the teacher's face and screamed profanity at him. Other students started to get involved, and there was some concern that things could turn violent. Well, the teacher decided to cancel the class. This was a class specifically aimed at exploring the issue of hate speech in society. Again, certainly more and more relevant, but apparently it is no longer possible to have an intellectual discussion at one of the most prestigious universities in the country on that subject. So Dennis Leap's Trumpet article addresses that issue. Expression suppression is the term that he gives for it. So watch for that article. And so we're sending this issue to the Trumpet, to the printer later on today. That's always a nice feeling of accomplishment. At the end of the program today, I have a special last word. It's special because you don't have to listen to me give it to you. When I'm not managing the Trumpet magazine and recording on the radio, there are a couple of other side jobs that I get to do. One of them is to instruct public speaking at Herbert W. Armstrong College. That's a job I really do enjoy. And this past Sunday at the college, we had our annual speech banquet. And for the first time ever, we did something that made it extra special. We linked our three different campuses, what is now three campuses, via Skype. We had the group in Edstone and the group in Jerusalem tied in. And so we were able to not only connect with them so everybody could hear all the speeches, but we had speakers featured at each of the campuses, a couple over at Edstone and three over in Jerusalem. And so it really made everything very exciting, and to have everyone unified and experiencing it together. Here we had a brunch, and over in Edstone and Jerusalem, they had dinner, being in a time zone where the time was later in the day. But we heard a very entertaining speech about the dangers of becoming a smombi, that is a smartphone zombie. We heard a speech about from Jerusalem about life in the archaeological dig from the perspective of one of the buckets. There was an article on or a speech on trying to track down a couple of items in Cologne, Germany by somebody who doesn't speak German. We had a speech about work ethic, one about journaling like a historian, one about miracles. The last word that I want to share with you today is one of these speeches, and I think I may do this with another one of the speeches next week, but this was given by George Haddad. He's an Armstrong College student who's over in Jerusalem now, and he shared a lesson that he learned from his experience at one of our youth camps about the importance of compassion. The title of his speech was "The Gift of Second Chances." So I do hope you stick around for that. I think you'll really enjoy that at the end of the program today. For the main part of the show, we're going to look at something that I feel is very important, and I think it would be easy to overlook or to fail to really grasp its significance. But there are just a lot of important points and instructive lessons that we can take from this. Last Friday, we saw the first indictments handed down by a grand jury led by Special Counsel Robert Mueller in his investigation into Russian meddling in America's last presidential election. Now, who was indicted? 13 Russian nationals, three Russian businesses, on charges of conspiracy to defraud the United States. They say there was a multi-million dollar Russian operation to sow discord in American politics as far back as 2014. Now, a lot of what was revealed by these indictments we did already know, but now, of course, we have the names of these Russians who waged this what they're calling a disinformation campaign against the United States. And I want to draw some larger points from this story, but just to get us up to speed, yesterday I interviewed Trumpet writer Andrew Miller about this. He's working on a story about it. So I just want to start by playing for you this interview from yesterday. Hello, Andrew.
Hello.
First of all, if you could give us an overview of what Robert Mueller is investigating specifically, and then tell us about these indictments.
Yeah, because he was appointed as a special prosecutor to look into the allegations of collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia. That was a big part with like the Steele dossier and other parts at the beginning of the year. So after they fired James Comey, they brought Robert Mueller, who's a former FBI director, in to investigate that. And he's been investigating ever since and hasn't found any evidence of any American colluding with the Russians or the Trump campaign colluding with the Russians. So mm-hmm. This indictment is actually a little different, significant, but a little different than what he was investigating, in that he's actually found evidence that of something that a number of security analysts have suspected for a while, that an agency in Russia called the Internet Research Agency was hiring, I guess, like internet trolls or social media operatives to sow social division within the United States by taking out like Facebook posts, Twitter posts, other news articles that will take both sides of an issue. I think one of the more famous examples that comes to mind that wasn't necessarily in this indictment but happened last March in Houston, Texas, where there were two Facebook groups. One was like United Muslims and one was like some like Patriotic Americans. And so you had like this one like very rural country farm movement and this one like very pro-Democrat, very Muslim movement. Both movements existed previous to any Russian intervention, but they established a Facebook page for these both groups, grew them till they're about 250,000 in each group, and then scheduled a protest for the same mosque in Houston on the same day at the same time.
Mm.
And so you have a counter protest with people yelling and throwing stuff at each other because they're just by coincidence there at the same time with their Sharia Law for America rally and your like anti-Islam and politics rally.
Yeah. Now, what you just described, this incident that you're describing, this has actually been known for some time. Like there are articles that came out October, November of last year that were describing exactly what you said, where at the time, as people were in the heat of the moment, they didn't realize that they were actually being played by Russian operatives. They felt like they were following Americans who had created these pages and organized these groups. How much of what's in the Mueller indictment is new information, or is this just confirming something that we basically already knew and then slapping these indictments on specific individuals? What, 13 Russian nationals, three Russian companies?
Right, and pretty much those, I think the 13 Russian nationals is probably the only new information to the Republic, I believe, to the public. We didn't necessarily know who the 13 people were before the Mueller indictment told us. But as far as the three companies, the Internet Research Agency, people definitely knew about. Senator James Lankford here in Oklahoma has been writing, he testified before Congress about that last September or October, about the like the take a knee protest at the NFL, where you had Russian Twitter accounts taking boycott NFL hashtags and take a knee hashtags supporting both Black Lives Matter and those who are against those supporting the Black Lives Matter at the NFL.
Yeah. Tell us what all these folks were doing specifically related to these indictments. Clearly they were trying to polarize the electorate. They were supporting Donald Trump, but they were doing other things too, trying to stir up anti-Trump sentiment and even with other candidates.
Right, and the indictment itself points out that they were anti-Clinton, anti-Ted Cruz, anti-Marco Rubio, but pro-Bernie Sanders and pro-Donald Trump. And the indictment itself kind of makes it seem like that what they were trying to do is disparage any candidate except for Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders in the hopes that Bernie Sanders would be popular enough to split the Democratic vote and tip it to Trump. That's the indictment's analysis of it. There's a number of other analysis that think that could be biased. The fact that Russia had a clear favorite it wanted to win, because there's who was the Daniel Hoffman, who's a former CIA chief, did a piece in the Wall Street Journal back in January called "The Steele Dossier Fits the Kremlin Playbook," where he even mentions that they already had like a democracy RIP, democracy RIP hashtag ready for a Clinton victory to try to stir up like Trump supporter sentiment against a Clinton presidency. And based on his 30 years in Soviet espionage, was thinking that was more likely, that they were banking on a Clinton win but wanting to weaken the Clinton presidency by having those who think their election was rigged.
Mm-hmm.
And no, happened the opposite of that. But it doesn't really matter if your goal is just to spread weaken an enemy by spreading civil division.
Mm-hmm.
Whoever is in office has half the nation that doesn't want them in office, and that's not completely Russia's fault. That's a trend that's been political polarization has been a trend that's been worsening in America since the 60s. But the Russians can certainly fan some flames there.
It's really extraordinary to have all of this exposed to public scrutiny. We can see exactly what the Russians were doing. We know who did it. We know exactly all of the tools that they had in their arsenal or the weapons. And we can see specific Facebook pages. We can look at, I'm looking at an Atlantic article from November 27th of last year, 2,700 Twitter accounts controlled by Russians and 36,000 suspected Russian bots that generated 1.4 million election-related tweets, receiving 288 million impressions during the final 10 weeks of the 2016 presidential campaign. Google discovered suspected Russian agents uploaded more than 1,000 YouTube videos about divisive social issues. Facebook revealed that Kremlin instigated content may have reached 126 million Americans, more than a third of the U.S. population. It's all laid out here, and yet I don't believe that even though it's all exposed in this way, that we're going to see Americans look at the evidence and say, well, wait a minute, we've been played. The hatred that we're feeling for the other side, this is basically like someone's been kind of jerking our strings and turning us against one another. We can't let them do this to us.
Right. And it's interesting is Vladimir Putin, in addition to being president of Russia and a former KGB intelligence officer, is also a black belt judo operative.
Hmm.
And if you look back during the time period when he was in KGB, that was definitely Soviet espionage theory, is that what you call the subterfuge or subversion. Subversion is the word I'm thinking of. But it's a subversion of an enemy is like a judo match. You can't throw your enemy in a direction he's not already going, but you can identify what way he's going to go and push him that way really hard in hopes he'll like fly into a wall or fly into the floor or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And this is back during like communist Cold War times, where they said that, well, that's what like communist subversion of United States is like. It's like these trends towards more socialism and more communist thought have been building in America of their own accord. But we're going to send Russian teachers over there and push them hard to go that way.
Mm-hmm.
It's similar here, is that, like I said, this, since the 60s, and I don't know, I guess some of that since the 60s, that was when communist subversion was taking off in America pretty hard as well. But you've seen the political parties start to diverge to the point now where a lot of analysts think they're more divided than any point since the Civil War. To the point where they almost hate each other, definitely on the left side of it, the hatred towards the Republicans almost exceeds the hate of a foreign rival. And that is what you're seeing with a lot of this this partisanship and bickering, is that no one's worried about Vladimir Putin. Mm-hmm. On either side of the political aisle.
Right.
He's just a convenient what he's done is a convenient football for them to throw blame at the other political side.
Right.
Which is exactly what he most likely wanted in the first place.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And do you have a sense of say the way that the press and the way that people are responding? These indictments came down last Friday, and it's interesting when Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein announced them. He explicitly said this indictment doesn't show any evidence of collusion with the Trump campaign or any other American citizen. He talks about the Americans who were involved in it being unwitting accomplices in what the Russians were doing. And yet, is this changing the narrative at all? Is there a sense that, well, okay, now even when you have Mueller coming out and saying these are the people that we're going after, they're Russians, not Americans, does it change the narrative at all in terms of President Trump's guilt, or does it cause the temperature to come down in the argument between these partisan parties?
No, unfortunately not. Probably just the opposite, in that I read through the indictment itself was a little biased in the fact that it really did focus heavily on Russian attempts to disparage Clinton and prop up Trump, even though you can get from other sources their same company had a lot of attempts to disparage Trump and prop up Clinton that it doesn't cover. Mm-hmm. But the major media coverage of the indictment is even worse yet. Because the indictment, like I said, it may have been a little one side on what Russian activities it's focused on. Mm-hmm. But like I said, they did say that there's no evidence of American collusion with the Russians, where a lot of media sources are now talking about, like, well, Trump has not taken this seriously, and this is proof that he needs to step down. And
everything is proof that he needs to step down.
So I do think that it's not going to change anyone's opinion who thought that Trump colluded with the Russians remains the same or has gotten more so, and anyone's opinion that he didn't has remained the same as well.
So we talk a lot about just how dangerous the forces that are arrayed against the United States are. And in this case, it does seem very clear that if Americans were to unite against a common enemy rather than to allow that enemy to use judo tactics in order to get us to tear each other apart, that we could actually prevent this from happening. I mean, we're using our own, it's because of our own weaknesses and because of our own internal divisions that these things are being exacerbated and becoming really like a matter of warfare rather than just a petty argument within the family. But looking at it from the standpoint of Bible prophecy, we do talk quite a bit about just how the Bible's prophecies of the United States falling from the position of power that it has assumed for quite some time. How do you view this playing into those prophecies?
This is definitely interesting because you don't see many prophecies regarding Russia and the United States together directly, but that is something, especially in the Ezekiel End Time Watchman booklet that Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury has written. There is a section in there where he's talking about like this overview of the third and the third world war, the world war that leads right up to Christ's return, where he talks about there's a king of the south pushes at the king of the north, and then the king of the north comes against the king of the south like a whirlwind, enters into the glorious land or the holy land where Jerusalem is, and then tidings out of the east trouble him. And he goes away to conquer many nations. Mr. Fleury makes it's a little bit speculation, but speculation that are becoming more and more verified, that those tidings could be the fact that Russia's got designs on conquering the United States. Especially if you take the big view over the last century of Soviet and post-Soviet efforts to stir up race war and civil war in America so they can take advantage of the internal division. That is something that if the King of the North would ever find out about that, that would be tidings out of the East that could be the catalyst that prompts them to invade first. Mm-hmm. 'Cause it's something that Mr. Herbert Armstrong said for years, is that Russia is not going to militarily attack America. A military attack is going to come from a united Europe. Mm-hmm. But Russia was and still is waging like a psychological warfare, right, against the United States.
Yeah, and even when you look at the details of that prophecy, the thing that basically reduces America to a state where it is susceptible to foreign invasion is the internal division and the violence within the cities and the social fabric of the country is fragmented and ripped apart by internal division, and to the point where you have people, Americans, killing each other. And you can certainly see how the trend is moving in that direction, exacerbated by efforts along the lines of what Russia has done here. They certainly see a weakness and a proclivity of Americans to give way to this kind of highly emotive, divisive, violent, angry type of emotion, and playing that against us to the point where we would actually tear ourselves apart. So definitely a lot there in that Ezekiel booklet that we can take note of. Well, we've been talking with Trumpet writer Andrew Miller about this disinformation campaign that Russia has waged against the United States. As noted in the 13 Russian nationals indicted and three Russian companies indicted by special counsel Robert Mueller, a grand jury indictment last Friday. He's actually written an article. Andrew has written an article for thetrumpet.com on this. He's working on it. Should be up soon on the website. The title of the article, The Truth About Russia's Disinformation Campaign. Go on to thetrumpet.com and check it out. Andrew, we appreciate you talking with us, keeping us up to speed on all these developments.
Pleasure to be here.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
We are back. This is Joel Hilliker. I am live again after that that interview with Andrew Miller. And I just wanted to talk about some of the deeper lessons that we might be able to take from what has happened here. Who are Americans' real enemies? If you watch the social and political scene in America, it seems clear that most Americans consider their worst enemies to be other Americans. We see widening divisions between political parties, between liberal and conservative, between economic classes, between races, between different religious and moral persuasions, between gun control advocates and Second Amendment enthusiasts, just to name a few. The divisions just keep multiplying. Now, this is a childish wish, I know, but I wish that all Americans of every political and ideological and racial and economic stripe would think seriously about what this Russia investigation is confirming, what we learned from those indictments last week. It really is painful proof that by fighting each other, we are playing right into the hands of the nation's real enemies. And it does teach an invaluable spiritual lesson if we'll open our eyes to see it. We've known a lot of what was revealed in this Mueller indictment for months, but this really makes it official that these hackers skillfully leveraged our own social media tools and even our mainstream media to foment these hatreds within America. You can look at, there are a lot of stories out there right now that are going back and looking at some of the media coverage of, say, what happened in the United States right after the election, and they're showing how even high profile media personalities were promulgating the narrative that was exactly what the Russian hackers were trying to create. It's all laid bare before us. You know, these Twitter accounts, over 2,700 of them that were controlled by Russians and Russian bots that were spewing out all of these millions of election-related tweets full of polarizing rhetoric. Never Trump, never Hillary. Really trying to tear down both sides. Over 1,000 YouTube videos on divisive social issues uploaded by Russian agents. All of these Facebook posts devised by Russian saboteurs that hit over a third of America's population. You can just open the Kremlin's playbook and you can see exactly how they operated, how they used this toxic combination of truth and lies and half-baked accusations and inflammatory insults to stir up anger and hostility and hate. Now, by military spending standards, they were able to do all of this on a very modest budget. But if you have several millions of dollars, that gets you a lot of exposure on social media. So these agents, they created a lot of their own content, but they also took posts that were created by Americans that were angry and fringy and conspiratorial, and they blasted them to bigger audiences. And so Americans, by the millions, were looking at this content, and they were getting outraged by provocative material that was served to them directly by Russians. And hundreds of thousands of Americans shared this and spread this to millions more Americans. They became unwitting accomplices in Russia's effort to weaken and destroy our democracy. That is really extraordinary. Jonathan Albright is a research director at Columbia University, and he told the New York Times last October, this is cultural hacking. They're feeding outrage, and it's easy to do because outrage and emotion is how people share. Think about that. This is how we share in the United States, thanks to our social media. And there's a lot of talk now on how do we address this? How do we fix this? But it seems like they're really trying to hold back a tempest with a net. It's just a very difficult proposition given the habits that Americans have developed. You look at all of the tactics that the Russians used, and they really have a knack for playing on our fears and amplifying our suspicions and pushing our buttons. The New York Times, this article from October 9th, 2017, it gives some examples. There was a fake account that was named Being Patriotic, and the Russians used that to promote an InfoWars story that claimed that federal employees were essentially stealing land from private citizens. And then they added the line, the nation can't trust the federal government anymore. What a disgrace. There was a fake account called Secured Borders, and the Russians publicized a video that falsely accused Michigan of knowingly distributing welfare benefits to Muslim immigrants with multiple wives. There was a fake account called Blacktivist, and it posted viral videos of police violence. Just think about the Russians behind these, and they really have Americans' number. They know what motivates us. They know what gets us stirred up. Andrew mentioned in that interview, I'll just give you a few more of the specific details, of this amazing instance where this Russian organization named Internet Research Agency, very innocuously named, it created two Facebook groups. One of them was called Heart of Texas, and the other was called United Muslims of America. And to the Heart of Texas Facebook group, it spread posts that were denouncing the spread of Islam in Texas. And then to the United Muslims of America group, it was spreading posts that highlighted discrimination against Muslims. And, you know, each of these groups, these Facebook groups, accumulated over 250,000 followers each. So the Russians, after they had laid all of this groundwork, then they announced a protest to each group. The protest that they announced to the Heart of Texas group was Stop Islamization of Texas. And then for the United Muslims of America, they announced the Save Islamic Knowledge protest. And they put them both on the same day, at the same time, in the same location. This was last May, I believe, 2017. So what happened? You can imagine exactly what they expected, exactly what they had orchestrated. You had angry protests with Americans against Americans on the streets of Houston, pro-Muslim and anti-Muslim, shouting each other down, and it was all instigated by the Kremlin. They played us perfectly. All of this that we see shows you, Russia doesn't take sides. They don't care who wins an election. They don't care who's the president and who's the opposition, as long as America loses. That's all they're interested in. And just to step back and look at this, shouldn't we feel some shame? Shouldn't we be ashamed of ourselves? Shouldn't it stir within us some remorse for having let foreign antagonists fiddle with our emotions to turn us against our own countrymen? Shouldn't this be a wake-up call to reunite and really, to put it bluntly, to redirect our indignation against the people who are plainly exposed as trying to sabotage us? You see Russia operating by the same script with this infamous Steele dossier. You know, on the surface, this document was created as a weapon to impeach President Trump, or to keep him from office to begin with. But it was used to obtain a warrant to surveil a Trump campaign advisor and to trigger an investigation that has now dogged his entire presidency. He's been in office for over a year now, and this has been on the entire time he's been in office. He's been having to battle this. Now, that document ended up exposing partisanship and corruption within the Department of Justice, within the Federal Bureau of Investigations. It's discredited these two pillar law enforcement agencies. Daniel Hoffman is a retired CIA station chief. He served in the former Soviet Union. And he wrote an article in the Wall Street Journal. This was dated January 28th of this year. The Steele dossier fits the Kremlin playbook. That's the title of his article. And he said this dossier, it probably was not specifically aimed at Trump, but was, quote, part of a Russian espionage disinformation plot targeting both parties and America's political process. He wrote this after 30 years' experience observing the Russians. He said, if there's one thing I have learned, it's that Vladimir Putin continues in the Soviet tradition of using disinformation and espionage as foreign policy tools. And what brilliant success he has had. And we as Americans have ourselves to blame. The Russians would never be able to do what they did if not for Americans' shallowness and ignorance and rashness and prejudice and partisanship and disloyalty and a whole lot of other weaknesses in our national character that, if you think about it, are being dramatically exposed by these events. If America were strong and united, if we had our eyes fixed on the real issues, this nation would be invulnerable to these kinds of attacks. But as I mentioned in that interview with Andrew, I still see no evidence that, in spite of all of these revelations coming out, that it's going to inspire any kind of a change of heart. If anything, it's caused Americans across the spectrum to intensify their accusations, their recriminations against other Americans. The Trumpet's editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, he's written an important article for this April print edition that we're sending to the printer today. As I mentioned at the beginning of the program, Nunes memo exposes unseen threat to America, and talking about the memo that exposed the truth about the Steele dossier. And he makes a strong point in this article that the real enemy of the United States is actually not Russia. It is an evil spirit being, Satan the devil. You have to read this article because it brings out this crucial spiritual dimension to really understanding the danger in these threats to America. If you study the Russians' divide and conquer tactics, the way that they've been laid bare by the Mueller indictments, you get tremendous insight into the way that the devil works. He is actively striving to destroy this country, and he's using every trick, every tool, every weapon that he has to isolate us, to break us, to shatter us into rivalries, And like the Russians, he plays no favorites. He takes every side and he takes no side. Revelation 12 and verse 10 calls him the accuser. He accuses, maligns, and scorns people. It says in that verse, day and night. He's always at it, zealously trying to bring people down, to cause division, to cause problems. He takes shards of truth. He mixes them with lethal lies to create suspicion, to foment fear, to turn people against one another. He stirs us to push reason aside and just act out of emotion and passion and hatred. You know, in 2 Corinthians 2 and verse 11, the Apostle Paul warned that we must not be ignorant of the devil's devices. If we're ignorant, that gives Satan an advantage over us. Well, Americans are definitely oblivious to the devil's devices. And as a result, our nation is falling right into his trap and we're ripping ourselves apart. But, you know, thanks to these recent revelations, we can no longer claim ignorance of Russia's devices. You know, it's all there. It's plain. It's available for anyone to look at and to study in detail. And yet we're still too locked into this divided mindset to make any changes that would nullify Russia's advantage over us. When you look at the Bible, you see that this nation is cursed. God has cursed the nation because of our sins. I think it's the most difficult thing to convince Americans of, that they are the problem, that we are the problem. We're so accustomed to pointing fingers at the other person. We're so accustomed to assigning blame rather than accepting responsibility. Here's an instance where Americans could do something. They could say, look, we were duped. They got us, but we're not going to let them get away with it. God wants us to take responsibility. He wants us to acknowledge our sins and repent of our sins. But I just don't see any evidence that that's going to happen. In that interview with Andrew, we talked about the consequences. We talked about Ezekiel's prophecies of terrible social breakdown. I implore you to look into those prophecies. You can find them in Gerald Flory's booklet, Ezekiel, the End Time Prophet. Go on to thetrumpet.com and read that and study that, and you can see where this growing division and hatred within America is leading. It really is a matter of national survival. Who are Americans' real enemies? Americans are ignoring this question, and they're turning their animosity against one another. And by doing so, we are playing right into the hands of our real enemies.
It's time for today's last word.
This past Sunday at Herbert W. Armstrong College, we had our annual speech banquet. We heard 9 speeches from our students, and I want to share one of these with you. It's given by George Haddad, one of our students who is over in Jerusalem right now. He shared a lesson that he learned at one of our youth camps about the importance of compassion. The title of his speech was "The Gift of Second Chances."
Thank you, Mr. President. Good morning and good evening, everyone. PYC is a time of laughs, fun, and lessons learned. I was given the honor to be head counselor for 6B this past PYC, Paul's Prayerful Pack, as we call ourselves. Now, as workers, we prepare for PYC as best as we can. And this one, God was preparing as well. He was preparing the counselor for the campers, but also the campers for the counselor. Tonight, I would like to explain how God used PYC to give me a second chance. When we look back on our lives, we can see upon reflection that when we've failed or when we've messed up, God usually provides another opportunity to make it right. About 2 years prior to this PYC, I had been given an opportunity to show love and concern and compassion for fellow man. And I did the exact opposite. This experience, although it worked out fine, It makes me cringe a little bit at the person that I was. A friend of mine had just spent time explaining their hardship. Crying and unsure, they were looking for me for comfort, for compassion. And after listening and thinking that I understood everything they were saying perfectly, after thinking that I understood their pain, I uttered words that I thought were really supportive. It'll be fine. Just get over it. Move on. These words in the context of maybe losing a game at a sport or missing a few notes on the piano make sense, but not when someone's explaining the death of a loved one. This poor choice of words came out of my mouth as smooth as butter, but as hard and as fast as a bullet. I didn't feel their pain. I didn't understand their pain. I didn't even care about their pain. I just cared about being the helping hand. Except rather than reaching out, I pushed away. 2 years prior to being a PYC counselor, I failed to show compassion. But God gave me a second chance using a special camper. Nighttime in Dorm 6B was a riot. There were a lot of laughs and a lot of fun. Campers chatted as they prepared for bed. Usually my one witchy and my one funny camper would make a joke and set the dorm alight. You could see the room had 10 smiling faces every night. But this one night was different. There was only 9 smiling faces. There was one camper sitting on his bed, holding something and looking absolutely miserable. As workers were told about the possibility of homesickness, and I thought, I don't know how to relate to someone who has homesickness. I'm from a faraway country and I've never missed home. And now I'm in another faraway country and I don't miss home. So I was thinking, I do not know how to relate to someone with homesickness. But I knew something needed to be done, and something needed to be done to get him out of his funk. So I knew he couldn't be left alone and he needed some attention, so I asked him to come with me to another room. I soon found out that it wasn't homesickness plaguing this young boy. A seemingly difficult situation escalated very quickly. As soon as we walked into the other room, he grasped my waist and began sobbing. I froze in place and thought, what am I going to do? I asked him what's wrong, and what he said I did not understand at first, but then we talked and he explained. He said, PYC reminds me of them. He then went on to talk about the death of a sibling. If I acted the same way I did 2 years prior to my friend, then that would have been disastrous. God was allowing me to practice compassion once again. And this time, a lot more was at stake. I didn't turn to this boy and emotionlessly say, it'll be fine. Just move on, get over it. It is a weird feeling having a child grasp you and cry. Although the situation is similar to 2 years prior, my friend was an adult. They had a lot of support, and they knew the type of person I was, a very blunt and direct person. This camper didn't have any of that. They didn't have any of that. It's as if God used my friend to show me that I lacked compassion, and he used this camper to allow me to practice it. I didn't know exactly what to say. I just remember saying a quick prayer in my head, and then I said, say all that you want to say. We can sit here as long as you want. It'll be okay. God is with you, and so am I. I offered him some tissues. I will never forget the eyes that looked back at me, full of tears and just wanting some hope, wanting some reassurance. We then sat on the floor for about 40 minutes and we just talked. God used Philadelphia Youth Camp to move me in a way that changed my thinking and feeling forever. God moved me to move others. I listened to all that he wanted to say. He told me all about the laughs that they shared, the games that they played, and the fun that they had, and how that was no more. This fun-loving kid's life was just turned upside down, and it was chaos for him. And that night, it was my job to try and make sense of it for him. That boy didn't know about my life, but God did. I don't relate to homesickness, but I had gone through things that I was able to relate to this boy with. I opened up about my life, my laughs, my fun, my games, and my losses. I wasn't an emotionless statue. I wasn't a pushing hand. I was a friend. After talking that night, and comforting as best as I could, with God's help of course, that young boy went on to be one of my happiest campers. He told me that everything he was doing at PYC was for those that he lost. He said to me, at the last night at PYC when we talked again, he said, "Mr. Haddad, thank you for the amazing time and showing me what's important in life." He said, "Mr. Haddad, thank you for being the best older brother I've ever had." I was lost for words. I was the one who wanted to say thank you to him. Thank you for being happy, even though you were suffering. Thank you for allowing me to practice true compassion. Thank you for being a little brother. Compassion is a beautiful thing when done right. And I didn't do it right, but God gave me a second chance. With this camper who, in his eyes, I helped greatly, but we know it's God. And a camper who taught me many valuable lessons about God's love and the implementation of it. A camper who became my brother. He still talks with me today, sending me updates about his life. And at the end of each one, he ends it with, "I love you as a brother." Compassion is the difference between a pushing hand and a helping hand. In the future, we're all going to have people grabbing onto us, looking for comfort, looking for compassion. Think about what hand you'd rather have, pushing or a helping one. And we can all think about which one we're going to be.
I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Send us your comments on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks very much to my guest on today's program, Andrew Miller, and a special thanks to George Haddad for giving me permission to use his speech. Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan, and I'll leave you with this thought from Charles Krauthammer. To understand the workings of American politics, you have to understand this fundamental law. Conservatives think liberals are stupid. Liberals think conservatives are evil. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.